are going to do for your project for many weeks in this course is to supply a crystal structure to
You start, you can put it on right now.
It's a great pleasure to invite Professor Stefan Kottmeyer from the University of Kent. He's associated with the Center of Molecular Modeling and the Department of Material Engineering at the University of Kent. Professor Kottmeyer, actually he started as an experimental physicist and then sort of switched to theoretical side, mostly computational material science, and that's what his bread and butter is. Apart from that, he's a keen, he's a great teacher, and he has been sort of playing with different ideas of how to communicate with students in a manner that is different from the classical methods. And today he is going to talk to us on that method, that is the flipped classroom. Professor Kottmeyer.
Okay, thank you. Now,
when I was asked to talk to you here today, they told me this is for an asset colloquium. And you can imagine what my first question was. What does asset mean? That word hasn't any meaning for me. And they told me it's advances in science, engineering and technology. Yeah, the topic I had for today is not really an advancement in science, engineering and technology. So therefore I asked the permission to the organizer to rebaptize this colloquium for one afternoon, just for today, and call it for once an asset colloquium. Advancements in the teaching of science, engineering and technology. Because that will be really the topic of this afternoon. Another thing I learned about these asset colloquia is that apparently this is being podcasted to the field stations, which is a very nice idea. I like that. I have my own recording usually as well. I have this device on that records the audio and also the screen, which is then put on the internet later on. But apparently here this is institutionalized already. Very nice. Let's come to the topic itself, teaching of science. And the first question I would like to examine with you is, how do we usually teach science? And in order to get my point across, I would like to make a little game playing. I put on a different hat. I will for a while not be a science teacher, but I will be a teacher of Indian literature. And I assume that you are not a class of science students, but a class of Indian literature students. So I go back to the door and I enter as an Indian literature teacher. Good evening, class. The topic of the lecture of today is about a book probably known to most of you, a book by Rabindranath Tagore. And we will teach about one particular story in that storybook. You have all the copies of that book in front of you. Open it on page 77 and read with me. It's the story, Once There Was a King. When we were children, there was no need to know who the king in the fairy story was. It didn't matter whether he was called Shiladitya or Shaliban, whether he lived at Kashi or Kanau. The thing that made a seven-year-old boy's heart go thump with delight was this one sovereign truth, once there was a king. But the readers of this modern age are far more exact and exacting. When they hear such an opening to a story, they are at once critical and suspicious. They apply the searchlight of science to its legendary haze and ask, which king? The storytellers have become more precise in their turn. And so the lecture goes on and on and on for 1.5 hours. I put off this hat again and I ask you, do you think that Indian literature is taught in this way? I see several people nodding. No, you will not read the story in class. You will ask the students, read that story first at home, and in class we will discuss about the story. However, when we teach science, all students have their copy of the textbook in front of them, and we are at the blackboard, and we are explaining everything that is already in their book. So usually we are doing exactly the same thing as that literature teacher doesn't do. In our typical science classes, we just repeat the book. Why do we do that? This is probably not by accident. Well, I guess there are many answers possible on that question. Why do we teach science the way we do? But my take at it is the following. imagine I have no tools, no technology, just my body. And I know something, and I want that I want to communicate that knowledge to you. What is the only thing I can do? I gather you around me, and I start talking about what I know. That is the zero technology way to communicate information. And that's how people did it very long ago. Starting from the ancient Greece, I tell this from a European point of view, but probably you have similar periods in Indian history, where people who know something tell their knowledge to the people around them. If you have a little bit more of technology, imagine you can write books, not the printed books, but the handwritten books from the Middle Ages. Well, that way of teaching still survives. The knowledge is now not in the head of the teacher only. It is also in the book, but there is only one copy of the book. So a professor who wants to teach about Aristotelian physics goes in the morning to the university library, takes there the single copy of the physics of Aristotle that is available, brings it to the lecture room, and starts reading from the book, which is a very natural thing to do because you have only one copy. But since that time, humanity learned how to print books, humanity learned how to record sound, we have radio, we can record images, video, we have television, we have now internet that makes communication of all these things so much more easy. And still we teach in ways as if we had only our body and one printed book. Why is that? Well, in my opinion, this is just a matter of inertia. We teach the way we have seen our teachers teaching. And they did it that way because their teachers did it that way. And that's an uninterrupted chain that goes back over the Middle Ages till the ancient Greeks. We just do what we have seen done before us. That wouldn't necessarily be a problem. If that is an ideal way of teaching, well, no need to change it. But we should ask, is it really ideal? Is that way of teaching really efficient? So let's examine that question. I have this device on, and I will ask you one question about it. It's a question you can answer with yes or no, and one of these two answers will be for sure correct. And so everybody of you can answer that question, and I will ask you to raise your hand for the answer that applies to you. Don't be afraid, I will not ask you to explain your answer, just raise your hand. You're very safe. The question is, do you know for what reason I have this headset on? If you know it, so then the answer is yes for you, you can now raise your hand. If you don't know it, and these are all the others, raise your hand.
Some people can only have some guesses. They cannot say yes or no definitely.
Yeah, but I told in the very beginning that I have this headset on to record the audio of this presentation. So I told it to you. And yeah, okay. Then we are far from home. We usually trust our teachers a little bit, I hope. I told it to you, clearly, openly, and still more than one half admits, I don't know what is the reason for this headset. So apparently there has been a lot of information loss. One thing I clearly told didn't came across to many of you. And that happens all the time in lectures. We think we have given all the information that we needed. The students should have heard everything that they need. But there is so much noise on the transmission that only a limited fraction of that information arrives at the students. So information loss is a very problematic feature of the usual way of teaching. There is a second problematic feature as well, and that I can illustrate with another story. Actually, this seminar here is a very special one for me, because it's the very first time in my life that one of my children is attending a seminar of me. So this is the boy who is sitting there near the back. And he is now 11 years old. I didn't tell him that I would tell something about him, so don't be nervous, Jesse, you are safe too. So he's now 11 years old, and 2 years ago he learned 10-finger typing. In our country, that's 9 years old, that's the typical age where people learn 10-finger typing in additional courses at school.
Finger typing?
Typing with all your fingers, so the rapid way of typing, not the primitive one, but the professional one. And his younger brother, which is now 9 years old, he followed that course a few months ago. So you can imagine at our family table that we regularly discussed about typing in that period. And children nowadays, they learn to type on these devices. They have old laptops that the school provides, and that is their device to exercise the typing. But when we learned 10-finger typing, we used a very different device that was on typewriters. So we were telling the children, well, when we were young, when we had your age, we were learning to type on typewriters. Yes, typewriters, what's that? Never seen a typewriter. Of course, that's an object that doesn't exist anymore for them. So we explain them how it looks like, and we tell them, well, there are these buttons, you have to hit them, and there are the hammers and the ink ribbon and the wagon which you have to shift back and forth. And well, they think old-fashioned, but cool. So they seem to understand what this typewriter is about. And the discussion shifts to different topics, and after a few minutes, the younger brother of Josse asked, well, there is one thing I still don't understand about this typewriter. Once you have done all this, when you have typed your letter, how do you in the end print it? And that learned me all of a sudden that obviously he hadn't understood the point of a typewriter. He seemed like understanding it, but his question reveals that he completely missed the point. And that is happening in our classes continuously. We transmit information, part of it disappears in the transmission, the part that arrives is often misinterpreted, misunderstood. And unless the student asks a question, we are ignorant about that. We don't even see that they have misunderstood it. Now, at our family table, asking questions is very easy. There is a low threshold to ask questions. But in a typical lecture, I guess that the people here who teach know that it's sometimes very hard for students to come across the barrier to ask questions. And it's only at the exam that we discover that there is a problem, that they really miss the point. So the two big problems, in my opinion, about regular teaching is this information loss and our ignorance about what is really happening in the heads of our students. The most embarrassing aspect of all this is that our students know that this way of teaching is very inefficient. And the way how I very clearly felt that they know it is an email I received a few years ago from a student. I will let you read that email. It goes like this: due to an appointment that was fixed long ago, I will not be able to attend the first lecture of your course next week. Very polite student, no problem. Do I miss something important if I skip this first lecture? of course he will miss something important. Do they really think that I will take my time and I will ask them to devote their time for something that is not important? But his writings reveal that they do not find these lectures important, which is understandable after all, because if they are not efficient, well, why should they value the lectures? If they would go to the movies and they tell them, well, the first 15 minutes of this movie is for some technical reason scrambled, you will not see it, but nevertheless pay the full ticket and watch the rest of the movie, these students would protest. These first 15 minutes are important, but in a lecture, apparently not. That shows that they know that it doesn't work, and that's really embarrassing. Having deconstructed my own belief in this way of teaching, the logical question that is next is, can we improve on the normal way of teaching? Well, let's go back to what we ask from students. And I think what I will tell in the next three sentences is something that many of you tell during the first class of a new course. We used to tell the students, well, we give a lecture and you are supposed to digest that lecture afterwards. In the evening at home, you go through the material you received, you think about it, you memorize the first things, and if you meet a problem, write it down and ask me at the beginning of the next lecture. That goes on for a series of weeks, and then there is a longer break in which you have time to study everything for the exam. That means wrapping up, making some connections, memorizing the last things, and then you are ready to go for the exam. And these are very wise instructions, because the studying after the lecture, that guarantees that this information loss is recovered to some extent. And the fact that you have to find your own questions and ask these questions, that guarantees that these misconceptions will have no chance. At least we will know where your problems are and we can remediate them. But I saw already some people smiling while I was telling this. You know what 90% of the normal students do after that advice. They go to the lecture, don't do anything. Go to the next, don't do anything. After a few weeks in the term, they are completely lost about what you are talking. If you ask them a question, the class is silent because nobody has an idea what you mean. So classes become very unresponsive. But that's not really a problem because we have this long break where we can study everything and we are ready to go for the exam. And that's very inefficient because that means that in this period here we are losing, all of us are losing our time, the teachers are losing their time, the students are losing their time, and the real active work happens only in that red block of studying, cramming just before the exam. Flipped Classroom tries to go back to the first scheme, but in a way that it is impossible for the students to behave as in the second scheme. And the trick is just the flipping. You ask the students to study the material first, and when we meet in class, that is the time when we discuss their questions. So exactly the same as in the first scheme, but reversed. And in this way, you can force people to be active with the content of the courses throughout the term. That will require them less studying before the exam. And because you spread the memorization over a longer period, it also stays in the memory much, much better. That's easily said, but how do you do that in practice? Well, let's look at the scheme in more detail. We provide the students first tools by which they can study the material. And that can be either movies, text, or other web-based information sources. I will say something more about each of them later. very important is that connected to these tools, there is a set of tasks and questions. So every source of information comes with a dedicated question that is meant to find out, does the student understand that particular piece of material? For 1 week, they have to make a report out of that, so that all their answers on the questions go into one single report, typically a PDF file. And that PDF file is sent to the teacher, say, 1 day, 24 hours before the class session starts. That gives the teacher the time to go through the material and to identify which parts of the material are understood and where do we have problems. And then you make a targeted lecture on these issues where there are problems. I will give from time to time some specific advice, and this is the first one. If you would try that, and even if you insist to your students that you should behave in this way, you will typically find out in the first week that very few people have actually submitted their reports. Then you can do something that either makes or breaks this way of teaching. You can say, oh, that's a pity. Well, I have no other choice. I have to repeat the material here in class. Otherwise, you don't have your information. That's very bad, because students will immediately realize, I do not need to prepare this material. If we don't do anything, we just get it in class again. So, avoid repeating material in class. If students don't do the preparation work, it's their problem. They will not get a backup in class. If they have a specific problem about the material, then of course you can explain it in class, but not on a default basis. How do we guarantee or encourage our students to really to do this preparation? Well, I think there are two main tools, and one of them is the social pressure. If you are sitting in a class and half of your colleagues have done the preparation and they can discuss with each other and with the teacher about the material, well, you feel very silly if you are the one who cannot follow. So you think, next time I will do as my fellow students do. That's something that already has quite some impact. The other tool we have in our hands is the marks we give. I use now regularly this system that I give my students at the beginning of the term. In the first lecture, they get 4 out of the 20 marks for this course for free. They already have them. It's yours, 4 out of 20. But every time when you do not submit a report, it goes 1 down. That guarantees that up to the very last week of the term, there is a motivation for the students to fight to keep these 4 points in their hands. I also tell them, I do not consider the correctness of your reports. This is the learning phase. So you are free to make mistakes. You will not lose one of your marks if you make mistakes in your report. But if you don't submit the report, then you lose the point. So it's the action that is rewarded, not the correctness of the action. And these two together give in my regular courses a report submission rate of between 80 and 100%. Let's have a closer look at this pre-class material. How can it look like? And I distinguish between movies, text, and other internet-based information sources. Very often, flipped classroom is introduced with movies, and that's the most visible aspect of it, but I will tell in a few minutes that it's not necessary to do it that way. Nevertheless, let's look at movies first. How do you get movies for your classes? Well, we all have of many of us have PowerPoint slides about their classes. All your content is in these PowerPoint slides. A very easy thing you can do is teach one more year in the regular way, put this device on, and record your voice and the screen. And you have already something that is a very good basis for a movie about your topic. You can use standard video editing software. Many people in education context use Camtasia, where you can cut these movies, remove all the dead parts, add some pointers. When you point to the screen, you let some arrow pointing on the computer screen. So you can make basic but very useful movies dedicated to your way of teaching that course. And I will just show 1 minute of one of these movies. I will go to the learning environment in which I was teaching in this institute in the past few weeks, and I take one session on crystallography. So every topic has one of these pages where you see here on top when the report has to be submitted, how much time the student can expect to spend to this piece of information. There is a video, there are the slides that were shown in the video, and there is a set of questions. So let's open the video. This takes a few seconds, it seems. It's not coming, no problem. I have it offline here.
What we are going to do for your project for many weeks in this course is to supply a crystal structure to a density functional theory code and calculate the properties. That means that our first step will be, how can we provide the correct crystallographic information to that code? So today we'll deal with crystallography, practical crystallography. Learning the tools, how we can supply crystallographic information to DFT codes. And there are three ingredients to this. We will need to search for information about crystals. What do people experimentally know about the structure of a given crystal?
And that goes on for, in this case, I think about 15 minutes. So that's the basic source of information for that topic. They can follow the slides like this and make notes if they want. And there is the very important question or task that is associated to this. So in this case, they had to determine a crystal themselves and find it, obtain it from a crystallographic database and make a visualization of that crystal. So that's a way how you can convert your existing slide-based courses into something that is video-based. Some advice on this. It's very helpful if you keep your videos short. So don't make a recording of a 1 hour 30 lecture, because that is extremely boring to watch. Make already in advance, before you teach that lecture, make an cuts of topics, so something you talk about 10 minutes about something, and make sure that after 10 minutes you have a new subtopic and so on, such that you can easily cut this video into typically 10 minute sections. That's what psychologists have found out is our normal attention span. You can test that for yourself if you watch on YouTube. How often does it happen that you watch for more than 10 minutes to the same video? I think it's very, very rare that you do that. So don't require that from your students then as well. And an extra advantage is, if you have these short videos, it's much easier to modify it later. Because you want to change one thing in an entire lecture. That's very easy in text, but that's not so easy in video. If you have a 1 hour video, you risk that you have to repeat the entire video just to make that single modification. If you have short videos, you have only to redo the video in which that that particular section appears. How do you bring these videos to the students? Well, usually you will not store them locally or in your university. You put these videos on sites as YouTube or Vimeo, and you use some shell to bring them to the students. You have seen the shell that I used, which was a learning environment that is partly commercial, partly developed in our university. But you can also find free resources for this on the web. So I can recommend to you Edpuzzle, which is a free environment that does exactly this. It is a shell around YouTube or Vimeo videos. And a screen in Edpuzzle looks like this. You have the screen in which the YouTube video is played. You can decide where in the YouTube video it will start. You can omit parts of that YouTube video. And you can insert questions. So when the student arrives at this point in the video, it stops and a question pops up with an answer box where they can type the answer and you get a file with all their answers. So it's a low threshold and low no-cost source to try out this way of teaching. It's probably not useful to teach to a class of 200 students because the management tools are not so well advanced. But if you want to try this out once or for a small group, this will certainly work. Videos, yeah, but does that mean that every teacher should now become some video developer? And the answer is fortunately no, because there are also ways to use text-based information with flipped classroom. Many of us have good textbooks or lecture notes which we prepared ourselves over the past years. How can we use these ones in a flipped classroom setup? It's probably trivial to convert them to a PDF format, and then you can supply them to a social annotation site. Think about something like Google Docs, or something that is meant for teaching, the Nota Bene site. I give you the website, nb.mit.edu. It's indeed developed at MIT. And a screen in Nota Bene looks like this. At the left-hand side, I have a PDF which I can upload. In this case, this is a research article. And the students, if they log into the site, they see that file and they can comment on it. They can write annotations in the margin. And they do not only see their annotations, they also see the annotations of their colleagues and they can reply to their annotations. So you can just give your text-based material in advance, let them discuss for a week, and one day before the class meeting, if you look at that file, you immediately see where the hotspots are. There where students have been discussing a lot, that is a place where something interesting was happening and where you probably need to pay attention to in class, without the need to make a video. So this is ideal to use when you have courses that are well developed and where your text-based material is of a very high quality. If you do not want to make videos, if you don't have good text-based material, then you still have many other places on the web probably where you can find interesting information, either text or video. So there is nobody who tells us that we only can use our own material. You can happily steal, make your own blend, and offer this through Nota Bene or through Edpuzzle to your students. So that's the concept of a teacher who is not like in the ancient Greece, the one who knows the information and has to communicate it to the students. No, the teacher is now the coach who guides the students along the very rich set of information that is available on the internet. A different role, but an equally valuable role. I can easily tell that, but you are probably wondering now, does it work in practice? Show me some results. I will show some, for instance, on learning gain. How much do students really learn now in such a setup? I'm usually teaching to rather small groups, so I can't give you data with statistical significance, but in courses that I have been teaching for 15 years and then changed to flipped classroom a few years ago, I undeniably feel the difference. The quality of the interaction with the students has increased a lot. We have now regularly, every week, high quality discussions of a level that in the previous way of teaching was possible only at the exam. I often had the situation of the silent class that refused to respond to anything I offered them, that has completely gone. There are, of course, statistical researches into this as well, so I quote here, and you can find it on the slides later on, the link where you have the original report. There are many studies in this report where mainly American universities use this flipped classroom approach and compared old and new versions of the course with often very high rises in success rates of their students. You can find many, many examples of this. What is the impact on the study behavior on the students? Well, I questioned many of my students anonymously after the courses, and a few things which they answered is, it takes more work during the term. Which is no problem, because we saw that typically they did not work during the term before, so we just restore the situation that we want to have. And they also tell it's less work in the weeks before the exam. Something I didn't expect, but which consistently comes back in the reports, many students watch these videos more than once, even up to 3 times, sometimes more. Can you believe that? That they voluntarily come to your class again and again? Nobody forces them to do so, but spontaneously many of them do. And of course, if you watch the same class 3 times, you will probably remember and understand more out of it. Something quite important, students, I didn't tell them because I wasn't aware the first year, and they discovered themselves, it's very necessary to make notes when you watch these videos. Video is very different from text. If you have read a text attentively, and made some annotations, well, later on you can rapidly scan it and find the section that you were searching for. With a video, that's not so easy. So, to avoid that you have to re-watch an entire video to find that 1 minute where you were searching for, make notes while you are watching it the first time, and that will make the searching later much easier. What's the appreciation of the students? Well, one of them worded it in this way. I have been a student for more than 5 years now, and for no other course I have ever been so well prepared for the exam. Which is a testimony that showed me, yes, it works. It's a lot of work, but you benefit from it, is how another student worded it. Some were more critical. They say, well, if you watch these videos at home, your thoughts wander easily away. But they admit, well, in a lecture, it's not different, and there is no rewind button where you can catch up for what you lost. Now, you have the opportunity to ask the students who were taking the flipped classroom course on computational materials physics here at TIFR in the past few weeks. So if you recognize some faces on this class picture, I see some of them are also in the room, you can also ask them for their opinion later on. Other critical remarks, what would happen if all teachers would start using that system? Because then students would have to prepare a lot. Again, that's not different from what should be the normal situation. They have many lectures every week and they should digest all of them. So we are not asking something different. But okay, I realize that if they really have to do that, that can take a lot of time. And therefore, the system fortunately allows to economize on class time. There is no need to have 3 sessions for 1 course in 1 week. You can give them the material for 3 sessions and then have 1 session where you do the discussion. So you can save class time and that opens time to prepare the lectures for the other classes. And what's the impact on the time usage for the teacher? I'll start with the bad news. You don't gain any time. It looks attractive at first sight. I just give the videos to my students and I relax and let's go to the discussion session. Well, making this initial set of material takes as many time as teaching a course for the first time. So it is an investment from the teacher. But the good news is you spend your time in a better way. I cannot prepare my class once and for all. Every year again, there will be new answers and I have to adapt my class session on that. But the learning gain is so much higher that this investment is well spent. My last item is a question to you, of trying to answer for you a question, because I can imagine that some people now wonder, is this a system that I could use for my classes? I will ask you a few yes or no questions. So those of you who are teaching, try to imagine whether this statement applies to you. Every year, I'm teaching more or less the same story to my classes. If that applies to you, you can raise your hand. Only 3. Wow, that means that either very few people here are teaching, or you have courses that are continuously renewed. Good, well, the ones who answered yes, keep your hands up, please. Because there is a second question. Is this applicable to you? Do you feel the problem that your students are not very responsive? Oh, I see other hands going up. Okay. I would say if you answer yes to one of these questions, and certainly if you answer yes to both questions, then the flipped classroom format could be useful for you. If your course is something that is very much attached to the daily news, I can imagine in journalism that you have such courses, then it will be very hard to put that in a flipped classroom format. And if you are one of these magic teachers that succeed already with a traditional course to have a very good interaction with the students, then you probably don't need that either. But if one of these both are applicable to you, then flipped classroom could help you. Another situation where it can help is if you recognize this situation. Is this something some of you recognize? For some of my students, the course goes too fast. For the others, it goes too slow. Well, if you give them week by week their set of material, they can do it at their own pace. The ones who need to watch the videos only once, they can stop after one session. If they need to invest more time, they can do it. So it's a much more adaptive format that can take into account the needs of a specific student. Which ends my message. So if you want to see this and other talks that were recorded in the same way, you can go to my YouTube channel. I will not put this specific talk openly on YouTube because there are already several similar talks about this, but I will put it with a hidden link and I will give the link to the organizer of this seminar, and you will then probably receive it by the mailing list. So it will be there, I guess, for a few years, so you can always look back at it. And with this, I'm ready to take your questions.
data you showed, the bar graph, the traditional method had some 51 odd response, and the other bar said traditional plus online. How do you do two things together, traditional and online?
Well, especially if you would start using this method, it's probably too much work to redraw the course entirely. So most people start by, let's take one chapter and do it that way. And in that particular study, they had done the introductory chapters in the flipped classroom way and the following chapters in the traditional way. And already that was sufficient to increase the success rate, because apparently the students understood the basics thoroughly, and that allowed them to go smoother through the later topics.
The success rate was measured in terms of the performance exam?
Yes, yeah. In that particular study, this was just the exam, the traditional exam. That's another debate. You can discuss how useful are exams. I have opinions on that as well, but that's not a topic of today. But even if you keep the traditional exam, you can see this rise in success rates.
Can you have two questions? The first is, if you consider a batch, the weakest versus the strongest in terms of the background and the capability, can you say how much it varies?
You mean the diversity within one class? Yeah.
In terms of their background as well as what they came to, as an example, in a mathematical course.
The method is effective both for weak and for advanced students. So you can easily add optional material to this that lets the advanced students to go deeper. And especially, so let me look at it from the point of view of weak students. These are the ones you most easily lose in the class. So they will have a safe haven where they can quietly watch the material at their pace, so certainly for them it is efficient. And for the more advanced students, well, for them the class is often going too slow. They can speed it up if they want, and they can do other things if they want. So it works for both.
Okay, then the second part is the examination, question paper set, and the evaluation by yourselves, or is somebody else there?
In my own examples, well, I didn't change anything to the exam regulations of my university, so I was just taking the exam as I would have taken it for any other course. If you are inquiring whether I am then the objective person to judge about the success rate of the methods,
I will not ask Dave. I will just put that as an example. If you were to teach in the university here, there will be somebody. By chance, it may become yourself, but who is setting the question paper?
Yeah.
And the person who is going to evaluate, it may be you, somebody else. Then the students, out of their interest, they may study extra. But if they are considering only in terms of a grade,
yeah,
it may not matter much, even if they went through and studied extra, except for their satisfaction.
Yeah. But the effects I see are so large that the bias of who is taking the examination is only noise to the result. I'm quite confident about that.
I find it very nice. Thank you very much. But I have one question regarding methodology. So when I teach, say, maths, I'm teaching complex analysis, I can easily see how I adapt my lectures to this format. It's pretty much the same things I derive every time I teach. But when I teach something like biophysics and asking them questions in the class, my lecture is sort of changing a little bit depending on the answers they're giving. You know, I ask, what is life? What do you think? And they say something. I say something else. So I can see that this has now become separated out into a monologue that I prepare and give it to them, and into a dialogue at the end of the three lectures that they actually have a discussion session. So after this, do you go back and sort of edit the videos to put some of that in? How do you do it yourself?
Most of my classes are more like the mathematical version you described. I would say for, if you have already a dialogue, and if the dialogue is necessary for that topic, there might be less value in flipping that class. So I'm certainly not pretending that this is the universal method that should be applicable to all classes, no. So whether I take into account, whether I modify videos if I see that something can be incorporated that can improve them, well, that's a question of time. For the next year, I will add now a comment button next to every video and ask them if you see specific editing mistakes or sound problems in this video, then indicate this, and then I will see which videos are from the technical level the ones that are the most urgent to adapt. And I take for myself notes, this is something I would like to add there, and but it's a matter of time and making priorities. And that's the advantage again of keeping the videos short. You can isolate, depending on the time you have, you take the most urgent small ones and make your modifications.
I think one of the main problems that we're facing in education today is really that our objectives are misguided, in that we think what we need to do is to communicate information and to tell our knowledge to the students, mm-hmm. so that they will remember it. And you know, our whole education system is geared much to that. So the major problem is actually not how to deliver a better lecture, but you know, how to get away from delivering lectures at all. You know, and how to get away from just trying to transmit knowledge.
Yeah.
So if mm-hmm. we, you know, just think that we're solving the problem just by, you know, using various technology and removing the actual professor from the students at the first stage by having them listen to a 10-minute talk instead of sitting with an actual person in the room. It doesn't seem like that's really doing nearly as much as, say, we could do by, you know, having smaller classes with discussions from the beginning instead of lectures at all.
And then you often run into financial problems, because having smaller classes means more people to deal with these classes, and that costs money. So that's why I'm quite fond of this social annotation tools, for instance.
Yeah,
because
this is the problem, that we're not willing to spend enough money to have good education.
Yeah, but that is not something I can change. So I stopped thinking about that.
We have to change.
Yeah, but I struggled with that question, and after some years I said, well, I can get very depressed about everything that goes wrong in the way how our teaching is organized, or I can just forget about that and try with the tools I have, what can I personally do to make my courses as good as possible. And this is so far what came out for me. But I certainly agree, if somebody would offer a tenfold increase in teaching personnel, that would be helpful as well. But I can't manage that, so I do it my way.
I have two questions. First one is, how technologically savvy does a teacher have to be to be able to do what you're talking about, you know, break up the video and then insert a question.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how much does it require for a teacher to be that?
If you use a site like Edpuzzle, it is just as easy as you can imagine.
Okay.
You insert the URL of the YouTube video in a bar and it plays, and whenever you want to ask a question, you press ask question, type the question, and that's really it. If you do the editing yourself with Camtasia, well, I can again refer to my son. He started using Camtasia here in Mumbai 2 weeks ago, and he has already some of his videos edited on the web. So it is certainly not a very high tech level.
And my second question is there an age recommendation for a flipped classroom? I mean, a student age recommendation. Do you think that younger students would be able to adapt to this?
I have seen examples in secondary schools where they used it with 14 years old. As soon as a child is able to work a little bit independently, it is possible. Maybe not for an entire course, but at least to use every now and then.
Any other questions?
Okay, I
hear one comment. Okay, no, I want to just ask one question on what you did before. Taking this range of students in a class, what he said, weakest to the strongest, how does that limit the length of your question answer session? Because if there is a big variation, you might actually end up spending a lot more time because there are many questions which are to be answered. And vis-a-vis, if you have class which is more or less, they're all very similarly capable, then the class may be really small because you are trying to gain that time. So did you have that kind of experience on, you said the class was smaller in your case, but what happens if the class is too big?
That's indeed one of the challenges. It's a technique you need learn to master. I think the people who took the course here, they can tell you that so far I succeeded to stop exactly in time after 1.5 hours. And well, it's a kind of feeling you have to develop for what are the most relevant groups of questions. It's not possible to go into every individual question at once, but several questions probably refer to the same underlying problem. And well, let's try to focus on these. If there would still be need for extra discussion, well, why not use the power of the group? I tried it here, but it didn't work out that well yet. But there is the possibility to have a blog site next to your course. And if you have a problem that you know the students, some of the students can solve that for the others, put it on that blog site and let them discuss there. And take the blog reports into these 4 out of 20 points. So if you are not sufficiently active on the blog, either by asking or by answering, you can lose one of your 4 points.
Is there a sort of maximum size with which you try this? Because you get inputs from your students 24 hours before the thing, and you have to go through it before you are ready for the discussion. So, that's actually a lot of work for that last 24-hour thing.
Yeah.
So, what happens when the number of students increases?
Okay, that's certainly relevant. A lot of work. I should tell you that one of these, last year I had the unforgivable mistake to put my class on a Monday morning, which meant that I could spend the Sunday preparing it, and there was no way to do it on Friday because then the reports were not yet ready. So it's indeed some work in before the lecture starts. But you can control the amount of work by the kind of questions you ask. If you would use this system with 200 students, then you will have to ask more multiple choice questions. And then you get a statistical answer, which is also very valuable. I see that 20% of this group is thinking in this way, and 30% in another way, and the rest is undecided. So let's find out what is the underlying problem for one of them. With small groups, you can ask very qualitative questions, and you get a different kind of insight. So it's balancing.
Okay, yeah.
One advantage I see in preparing this kind of thing is that if you play it for yourself, you know where probably you can improve or you make a then mistake. Whereas when we prepare any slides and then give the lectures there. Okay, whatever we written in the slides is all right, but what we talk there, we do not realize some of the kind of thing we should have done differently. So in that sense, it is
probably. You can get critical comments from your students and from your colleagues because they can watch your lectures as well. And for some people, that is frightening.
Yes.
Okay,
the very last one. Yeah, please.
What has currently been the acceptance rate of flipped classroom in places where publicized yet?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear it completely. Can you repeat, please?
Yeah. What has been the acceptance rate of flipped classroom in places that you have publicized it?
I have no idea. At my university, this is a person-by-person decision. The university is promoting it, but there are only few people so far who use it systematically. I know some American examples where several courses have been flipped, but it's my impression that very often it's the decision of the teacher rather than an institute decision. Which makes sense, because if the teacher is not ready to use this system, it will not fly.
Okay, so let's once again thank the